Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome, everyone, again to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am, of course, your host, John Schmidt. And again today, as most weeks of the last several years, I'll be taking you out to the big picture, in to the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those that I always like to say are rich with the essence of constant renewal. Well, folks, welcome to the new year. This is our first show in 2013. We are up on the balcony again as we live into this era of extraordinary change. But moreover, I think perhaps now it is even more likely that we are moving into perhaps the greatest turn in the history of mankind, into an amazing new era of potential and evolution. If you were with us last time, last show, we got really way out of the box with futurist John Peterson. We reflected, I think, on this historic turn that's suggested for mankind. Actually, I think we even brought to life a view from way outside the box back toward in the box and the matrix of the accepted and the matrix of the science of the known. And I think we explored maybe just a bit of what in-the-box science is also discovering, or at least broadly pointing to it. Maybe even as John was describing DNA as one example and DNA research, and how new discoveries are reinforcing some aspects of the out-of-the-box perspective that are coming to view more clearly as we live day to day. So if you didn't listen to that show, do so. John Peterson, in my mind, is a solid and grounded thinker. As I mentioned in our introduction last time, I think he is a futurist with openness extraordinaire, which really contributes to that view and his capacity to see way outside the box and then live back in it and traverse back and forth. But I think in one context, even a listener that I talked with over the last several days said, you know, you even described to me in some of our outside-the-show conversations about where John has been. Not only has he worked in Washington and advised senior officials in the various military establishments that we talked about, but he was at times considered for senior administration roles, which I don't think he was particularly interested in. But one in particular was a slot about the Secretary of the Navy. And I think that one, if it might catch your attention, it might give you a better frame. If you haven't listened to the show, listen to it closely with that frame. He is a solid, he is a professional, he is someone that has grounded both feet on the ground. He is not a new age quack from the junkyard. He's seasoned, he is a futurist, he has uncompromising integrity, and he is pointing to a world of very new possibility. So folks, if you don't think there's a new and immense potential arising on the planet, I suggest you consider otherwise, perhaps reconsider it. Listen to that show, listen to John. I think that was a stepping stone into the year, at least from my standpoint on it. And it may actually be so far, if we really even think about this, it may be so far beyond some of our beliefs that we could be dramatically surprised by what's coming. And surprised is one direction that I want to add to our mix today. I want to move toward that, at least with sort of a particular mirror. But even while we even talk about that and even point, as I have at the opening of the show, to the balcony, and to considering the broad sense of the potentials that we are living, we are still in a very grounded reality. We are living in a very in-the-box system, and one that is very stuck in the mud, as evidenced again by the recent events, I think, of kicking the fiscal cliff down the road last week. So today, as we get started, as we launch into 2013, I want to do a bit of a reset from several viewpoints. I want to add some recent events, or bring in the recent events of the cliff. I want to bring that into the mix. I want to frame that reality and the scenarios that we have been talking about and those that we'll be living into this year and next. I want to bring them front and center as we get into the year with that potential reset. And I want to get clear on a baseline of perspectives that can underpin our anticipation or our coming year, and potentially to the relationship to the market, perhaps to our investing and trading, because of the nature of protecting our wealth, on one hand, is a substantial support to the new world arising. How we then actually engage the use and expenditure of our dollars in relationship to it is a function of how we manage through these times as well. So with this surprise context that I mentioned, I also today then want to introduce you to what I think is some interesting views that have been put forth by the United States Air Force, of all places, out of the Center for Strategy and Technology, the Blue Horizons effort that they have, potentially the group. I'm not quite sure how they designate it. They have some very interesting reports that are based on their own explorations and I think their own leading edge thinking, as they really even reflect that what we're living into is perhaps, as I'm calling it, the era of extraordinary change. They're calling it an age of surprise. And I think with that, we ought to at least tune into some of what their thinking is, some of their context, and the implications that they're pointing to for leadership. I think it's worthwhile to look at. And I'll bring that in today. And then lastly, what I would like to do today is I want to conclude perhaps with some news from the financial front, mostly probably from the last couple of months, December. I've been sort of putting some of this together, but stimulated this morning by seeing Bank of America has settled another couple of $1 billion in sort of the financial world of the last crisis that we were in. And I really suggest and want to point a close today with a sense of with this surprise orientation that I'm suggesting that we shouldn't necessarily be surprised that we are not out of the woods yet. We are still living a mythical world of high finance, and banks now, not only, as I've said before, and others are too big to fail, it seems to be they're too guilty to prosecute. And so I want to close with that today. But a mix, wouldn't you say, emerging and into a new world, the context of Peterson, the context of this new unfolding world of potential and possibility, the evolving human and human capabilities, as I have framed it for the last year as well, new world, new human, and that's what John Peterson often likes to call it. While we still continue to live the matrix of creation of this economic and political reality that is quite bogged down in the mud, rife with more conflict and polarization as we saw it again last week, and very much living manifestations of ego narrowness and perhaps more ego-based engagement and activity and conflict than we have seen ever before, certainly in our Congress. Amidst it all, though, I would say, as we get into the year, what a time to be alive. What an actual seat we have. We are both actors, and we are the audience, and we are living into an amazing human play that is really in dynamic form. So, again today, folks, three parts as we get started. Kicking the cliff down the road, some comments on that as a context and a reset. The age of surprise, as framed by the Air Force, and some implications for leadership for sure, and then the mark-to-myth world of high finance, where we shouldn't actually be surprised. It's likely at some point to crash again, but a few summary themes on that. So surprise, but don't be surprised. It's great to be with you. I am solo today. I will not be having a guest. I am integrating many viewpoints, as always. Today I'll be including a mix from Mohammed Al-Arian of PIMCO, who provides such great context that we add to it. Nouriel Roubini and team at RGE Monitor, as always. Tony Caldero, the objective Elliott wave, the flow of waves and perspectives and context of its relationship to the market. Today, Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, some thoughts that he's actually contributed to the mix, the Air Force, and always much, much more. I love to scan what we're doing, and as always, what you get on Zoomed is not only guests, but my integration and continuity of perspective that's a through line of this story that we've been exploring for 3.5 years. So let's get started today. Kicking the cliff down the road. And I do so because a couple of shows ago, I summarized the big view and I think I want to keep it current. I want to keep the baseline and alternative scenarios. I want to keep them alive, and I always want to come back and reset them when we have fresh information, like the fiscal cliff situation that we've been into. And I don't want to attempt, everybody talks about this, and I don't want to bore you with that. I don't really want to wade into, as the media does, the knitting and the picking, but I want to keep our attentions on the ball of what is really going on and how might it influence our leadership perspective in our particular domains. And recall, if you would, and I'm going to just maybe pick up a little continuity, recall that the main thesis that we've been talking about suggests that we are in the fourth turning. We are in a crisis period. We're in the fourth turning of a great seculum cycle, this one which is backdropped by the shift of our economic system into a credit-based world and economy where, much like a balloon, we have to keep pumping more and more air in as the current deflationary and debt tendencies have air being sucked out. We got to keep the air in the balloon while we find means to further transition our economic environment toward a third industrial revolution or something on that magnitude of order, which can serve to put us on the pathway out of our global debt mess, our global financial mess. Without something that large, it is going to be a big challenge. That's the background theme. Coupled with the realities of currency wars that James Rickards described so well, all of those among nations of the world, all of this together, which suggests difficulty that we see in the consumer and the private sector handling of credit and debt, it can't be taking much more. That leads it all back to, where does it come from? If you got to put air in the balloon, you need more credit, you need more being able to pump this up. Where does it come from? Comes from the public sector, comes from the government, and that, folks, is the rub. We already have debts and deficits that point to, at a minimum, intermediate term trouble. So, let me get started first. Let me just pick this up. You're probably tired here, Matt the Cliff, but you're going to hear much, much more about it. So, what about it, though? You know, we were anticipating a mini deal at best, not really a grand bargain, but I think in the words of Ellerian, I think we got a micro deal, and he actually expressed that, I think, really well. This deal has prevented us, for sure, and the U.S. economy from falling off the cliff right now, but it's really only kicked it down the road. And, folks, given the dysfunctional nature that we see every day of our political system, what we really have is a series of cliffs that are looming, and that's certainly what the media is talking about more broadly. In 2 months, there's going to be another sequester cliff. We got about $110 billion of automatic spending cuts scheduled for 2013. They've been kicked down the road. And about the same time, there's a renewed debt ceiling cliff catfight that's going to go on. And later on, just a bit later in 2013, a bigger debate on whether and how to achieve this medium-term fiscal consolidation, I think, that's going to be at hand. It's going to lead to another fight between the Republicans, who seem to want to downsize the government, and the Democrats, who want to maintain the size of the state, but they're unsure about how to pay for it. So what we have is, what we need to expect, are cliff fights over entitlements and fundamental tax reform, fights particularly on questions like, should we introduce a value-added tax or a carbon tax now that the tax cuts for 98% of Americans have been made permanent? Should we do it? Should we reform corporate taxes to get more revenues in the till? You know, Barack Obama and the Democrats really argue that the current deal, and I think they're correct, only raised about $640 million of revenue over the next 10 years, rather than the target that was being pointed at about $1.4 trillion. So I think that's on one hand, but the Republicans are going to argue for spending cuts, as the micro deal really didn't include any. So what can we expect? We can expect fisticuffs. We can expect these guys as fist fighters that continue really to box on the edge of a cliff throughout 2013. And as we, if you really even follow some of the news shows over the weekend, you're going to see some of that. Someone even yesterday, one of the congressmen described that going not only off the cliff, but shutting down the government is probably an appropriate activity or next step along the way here to bring this under the fold. That was a GOP congressman, I believe. So the reality seems to be that even though this is the backdrop of it, even though with that, it seems to me, from what I can see, that the average Republican voter, the average voter, who's probably whiter, older, maybe a little bit poor, perhaps, maybe not the most skilled, but certainly more religious, even that group is not in favor of gutting the social welfare state, despite what the Tea Party's radicals seem to be pushing. And I think that's why the Ryan Romney proposed budget plan postponed the Social Security and the Medicare cuts by a decade. So you get to get a sense of this. And I think, meanwhile, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are admitting that maintaining a basic social welfare state, which implies more taxes than just on the rich, it implies more taxes on everyone, really, that it's not sustainable. And actually, from the Democrat, the Republican side, this dream to starve the beast, as former Reagan's words really put it, really is only going to result as it's being lived out now, which I think someone, as I was reading this weekend, was describing that we can't and we're not able to effectively starve the beast. What we're getting is an institutionalizing of deficits with low tax revenues as far as our eye can see. And that's a very discouraging thing. That is a context for the balloon. Those that really suggest that we have more debt in that context, more need, more outgoing without building the capacity. That's just the baseline without even considering how we're going to get to this more dramatic, epical shift that we're talking about. So that's kind of the looking out the windshield. But if let's consider this, though, I mean, just to remind on this and the rear view mirror of this and perhaps to repeat, we did actually have a balanced budget or at least even a slightly small surplus if we go back to about 1998. And at that point, we were getting revenues in of about 20%. Of our gross domestic product. But then over the ensuing period where we ended up by 2010, given all of this impact that has occurred, we were getting only 15% of revenues versus 24%, and our 20% and our spending had increased to 24%. In essence, folks, we got a big gap we're dealing with. We've got perspectives on both sides that are rigid, that are institutionalized, that are sort of just polarized into a one right way. But the reality is we got here with Republicans who are now saying starve the beast on the back of George Bush, who in fact helped contribute to unsustainable tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, two very unsustainable wars, a massive increase in discretionary spending that went along with those wars, healthcare spending that went along with this unfunded pharmaceutical drug benefit. That's part of the backdrop, and it's probably not only the Republicans to bear cross to bear on that, but we can say that the deficit, in my mind, can be traced in part to bipartisan initiatives, and predominantly, I think it's been driven, and I think Nouriel Roubini and others are describing this well, but driven by partisan pandering. That's part of what we have. That's part of what's contributed to the morass of the reality that we see. So, while a reform of entitlement spending, and maybe not gutting it necessarily, will eventually be necessary to reduce government spending from this 24% down to something more reasonable, essentially, the approaches, both Democrats and Republicans that we're getting at this point, really were just not sustainable. That's the reality. And the trouble in the context of a gridlocked and dysfunctional U.S. system is that it's going to take years to get this reality actually on the table and to both raise revenues and to reduce expenditures to a sufficient level to get where we need to go, recognizing that we're going to support some degree of a social context around the welfare state. It is really a mess of a situation, really a mess. And all of this, well, let me just see how I might even want to frame this as we think about this, or what do I really want to say about this as we close this? I think what I would say is, given the gridlock of an ideologically divided government and Congress, the most divided probably that we've seen in 150 years, and I think some are actually measuring that with some rigor, that, and without probably market pressure by the bond vigilantes coming in and actually doing the work to really force the government's hand, and there's some rationale for that I won't get off on today. What it does is, the lack of market pressure, and without it, one cannot, I think you can't really expect a resolution of these medium-term challenges anytime soon. And that leaves the U.S. with probably the worst of all worlds. Meaningful drag in the short term, meaning we've got a real drag on our economy. We can anticipate that we're going to have at least a 1.2%, as the economists are describing, Rubini and others, drag on whatever the growth rate appears to be. And if it falls very much more, that gets us down into a stall speed. The fact of the matter is, we're going to have a drag on it in the short term. And we're not going to have a credible plan for medium fiscal term consolidation to stop this debt ratio that's really at unsustainable levels. And I would say, ugh, that is the reality that we're looking into. That is the reality we're facing. That is the backdrop of it. So that's the context I at least want to open with. It is a big ugh there, and we have then further cliffs that we will be seeing. But let me just mention that in relationship to it, the scenarios that we talked about. The three broad scenarios that frame and build on that are, one, the positive one, the possibility of the epical upshifts. Two, the hard times, kicking the can down the road, kicking the cliff down the road, the muddling through, the living as we're seeing it now. That's really the kind of the middle road on it. And the third piece of it is the perfect storm, where we begin to see more of a collapse out of it. Those are the ones that we're talking about, and those, I think, are very clear. But to me, over the weekend, Mohamed El-Erian of PIMCO made a wonderful reflection, I think, on the scenarios. And he said there are three scenarios, and I think they parallel well these three dimensions that I've mentioned here. We're either going to see one of three things: good economics and effective politics, which provides the basis for a growing and more productive economy. It's going to either be a bridge to be able to move toward this epical upshift, or we're going to see bad economics interact with dysfunctional politics, which is what we're living, and that's going to ruin the day. That takes us to the perfect storm. Or three, we're going to muddle through in an increasingly unstable kind of a world, a tug of war between economics and politics going to play out. We're going to have no clear result, no clear direction. We are going to vacillate in this volatility, and the great ugh, I think, is what we're actually seeing. And I think part of the answer about what's going to happen here, as Mohamed really describes, depends on what happens in three countries in particular. He points to China, Germany, and the U.S., certainly Germany in relation to the Eurozone. But current indications, albeit incomplete, these are his words, suggest that the three will continue to anchor the global economy in 2013. That's the good news, but the bad news is their anchor may remain both tentative and insufficient to restore the level of growth and financial stability to billions of people, to which billions of people aspire. That's a quote from Mohamed. I think that tracks real well with what we're talking about right here. So just as part of the reset then, the reset into 2013, given these scenarios, Muddle through, 75%. Muddle through has to be sustained by the fact that we have some positive, some movement to these cliffs. It also assumes that the Greece in Europe is kept on life support. It also assumes that we have Chinese growth continuing to rise, at least for the first half of the year, and that we don't have any kind of a Iran-related oil spike or conflict that we've been anticipating between Iran and Israel. The 75% there, the perfect storm, is the 25%. We don't have a great deal of a horizon for an epical upshift brewing for 2013, given the context. That's the 75-25 percentage. And, of course, the perfect storm could be, as we've talked about, this bitter political situation really stimulating even greater drag and an anchor to the economy. Even more than that, really creating a huge pier of contribution to the perfect storm, that we don't have sort of a Greek situation. We've got sort of this unilateral Greek default and exit from the Eurozone. It's really not well done. It creates a real problem where Spain and Italy have to be bailed out on to boot. China would be suffering even more, which is a lower probability in the Middle East conflict. So that's what would happen in those 25%. That's kind of the broad picture. That's kind of the broad perspective. The micro deal seems to have increased the likelihood, I think. And well, let me go back here. That's the kind of the picture. Let me give you the good news out of this, though. What I think the good news that we really have experienced in the last week, and that is the micro deal does seem to have increased the likelihood, at least to again move the probability up to more like 75%, that we're going to continue a bull market into 2013. We were at the inflection point, as I mentioned a couple of shows back, and actually at the precipice at SPX 1398 about a week ago. And we had an increasing bear market likelihood at that point. If we broke down below 1398, that was kind of like almost a line in the sand. But we had a rally that came beyond it. That reduces the bear possibility, I think, more like to 25%, as it had risen quite substantially more to 50%. All this amidst, I think all that's really based on perspectives that I have suggested before. If we look at the larger context of the speculum cycle from the way that we have and see three bear markets emerge during these periods, these crises periods, and you're able to look at the structure and evolution of the market and the wave structure and the framework for percentages and the kinds of magical numbers, Fibonacci's and others, that are actually included in it to give you some shape and frame of anticipation. But where we are, that's the good news. Not a done deal for sure. That's the good news from the market standpoint going into the year. 25% is a possibility, but the coming pullbacks, I think, will reveal much more about where we really are. But a plus amidst this political logjam that we see coming. So that's the fiscal cliff. I think the bull market continues. The baseline scenarios stand at 75%, as I was describing, unless we see a breakdown, the disorderly Greek exit, the cliff problem becoming huge, China really suffering, and the Middle East flaring up. Those, I think, are the anticipations. But what about surprise? What about this arena of surprise? I've talked about it before as we have talked and really shaped the thinking around breakdowns, breakthroughs, and surprises. I wanted to give you a context today of what the Air Force has been doing, some work that has been very substantial, very ground-bed, very thoughtful in what they're doing. Not necessarily way out of the box, but certainly as a leading edge inside the box. And I think they've been a real contributor in this way from at least my reading and exploration. I'm putting to the Air Force, to the Air University, to the Blue Horizons effort, Blue Horizons 1, 2, and 3, the most recent product, and you can actually find this on the web as well. You can take a look at it. It is called the Age of Surprise. And I bring it to you because I think there's some useful perspectives in this that really help us understand the way varying organizations are considering the reality of the world that we are living into, and the implications not only for the organization, but for leadership. You know, I peruse an awful lot of sources, and I have kept this Air Force perspective at bay really until I felt like it would link into our conversation more directly. And I think it does today, because despite all this anticipation and this context of what might be coming and the probabilistic views that we're attaching to some of these scenarios, we can also expect the unexpected. We are in an era of extraordinary change, and I think there's some dimensions of what the Air Force have described that's really useful to click into. They have lived a somewhat historic niche, actually, relative to our armed forces in anticipating the future. They've done it time and time again. They've done it well. They have been at the leading edge in anticipating the inflection points and the evolution of what's been occurring over the last 50 years. They have been there. They have been emphasizing this look into the future. They have been innovating, and they have been capturing the next technology wave repeatedly. And so I think today's reality for the military, much like the unsustainable economic and the policy strategy that I have described, is that in the military, today's reality probably can best be described as they describe it, and I can look at it and see it and agree with it. It's a boots on the ground strategy that's really no longer sustainable. Tomorrow's reality, radical change really by technology and the revolution that's going on, which calls for new thinking and new mindsets. And let me give you a few sentences from this Horizons 3 perspective that I looked at over the weekend, because I think it helps frame us in terms of a dimension and a parallel to the economics. And here's how they would say it. We as a nation find ourselves in an unsustainable boots-on-the-ground strategy when it comes to all responses in the war of terror. If every time a building falls in New York or a military installation is attacked in Washington, the only answer that the Department of Defense can offer the nation is a strategy that costs $1 trillion, leads to deployment of hundreds of thousands of forces, then we, the Department of Defense, are not only strategically, but we are also intellectually bankrupt. And has been the case throughout all of history. Tomorrow's wars will be different than today's, and we need to see through that change to that reality and the changes that lie in the future that will be spawned by technology revolutions. Anticipating, folks, tomorrow's realities, that's really what they're doing with Blue Horizon. And that has been the focus of each of these exploratory levels of Blue Horizons 1, Blue Horizons 2, and then Blue Horizons 3, which is not just out of the box here most recently. It is perhaps a year or more down the road from when it was initially issued. It's not perfectly current, but I think it has a backdrop of exploration relevant for us today. You know, the Air Force sees itself as living historically through, I think, inflection points, as we talk about inflection points often on Zoomed. They have the flow of history that goes back into the First World War, and their inflection points was led into sort of this strategic bombing orientation, and then the nuclear deterrence out of the World War II realm. It then led into stealth and precision, as we see in many of our stealth fighters, and it has evolved now into this age of surprise, as they have described it. And the driver behind this is the rapid technological change and the proliferation of technology in a really wide and expanded way. And this era, I think, as they would describe it, this rapid change arena, really brings to them, as they're describing, here's what they're really suggesting. that the way that they deal with the budget issue, the way that they deal with this unsustainable approach, is recognizing that they have to innovate and think their way through this to what's different now. They've got a budget busting operation cycle, which also contributes to what we're talking about in this budget mess that we are in, and that's part of what's underpinning this Blue Horizons effort. I think what they're describing as well is very much of what we've talked about, that the age of surprise is really underpinned by this rapid technological change, this proliferation. We have actually described the world of possibility and opportunity that comes out of this. But they recognize, just as we've been talking about, that it's like a hockey stick. They call it a J curve. And they are actually looking at it from the course of the studies view of how does this growth, how does this shift impact their mission, their strategies, their cultures, and their leaders. And where I'm wanting to go today and to end up with you is at least to point to the way they're describing the reshaping of their leaders, at least on an introductory way. I can't go through the bring to light all that's here, but there are some pointers to what really is being talked about. One thing that caught my attention at the outset, though, and that is a perspective for all of us to have as we think about how to innovate our way going forward, and it's this, that their studies show, and a very expansive look into it, that 70% of all new technological breakthroughs that are happening in the world are happening outside the United States. 70% of all of them are outside the United States, and only 30% of them that are happening within our borders. Of that 30%, 70% of that are really privately funded. They are breakthroughs over which the military has no influence or sway. Gives you a context, and that's really what I want to provide here, is a sense of the context that that we're beginning with in their organization and thinking, in the context of the implications for leaders, leadership, and the nature of surprise that pervades this environment. That's very interesting, I think. And I think that's very contrary to what we have in our minds about the nature of technology, the nature of innovation. We do have capacities here, but the realities of some of the data really caught my attention. From the context perspective, and context is everything for leadership, the new battle space, the context in which they're thinking about, has elements that are still surrounding it as always. It is their enemies, as they would describe them, are motivated by resources, by fear and hate, at least to a certain extent. That's not different, but they are now, and the nature of this process is different because they're empowered through education, enabled through technology and globalization, so directly in challenge to the United States. The enemy will be different. The targets they present will be more difficult to find. They'll be harder to hit and more widely distributed and more dangerous. And that's the context. That's the picture. That's the possibility that's really emerging here, is it's different in context than we've seen before. It is different, and just as we have seen on our televisions and we're seeing described about Afghanistan and Iraq, they are more difficult to find, those that we are seeking, harder to hit, more widely distributed, and very, very dangerous. So the point is, context provides a view forward, and they are beginning to shape even more fully the context that they're living into. That context also includes the fact that the nature of the technologies are so impacting the nature of the conflicts themselves. You know, because the cost associated with these technologies has come down, become so pervasive, so available, so actually available to everyone, that the study concludes that warfare in the future is going to change, that wars of high consequence, like the first two worlds, which have been rare and of low probability, and wars of high probability have been those that could be ignored, all that's changing. Wars of high probability are those waged by small groups and individuals, and they're going to become even more potential of high consequence as a result of their access to increasingly inexpensive and distributed technologies. Essentially, folks, this exponential change in the context for the military is describing the change as real, inevitable, driving proliferation. It's a result of synergies across a number of areas, two of which they really went into in depth, nano and biotechnology and the pharmaceutical link between the two and the cyber world. The big opening context, it's profiled here, and it is essentially that this technological change is privately led and governments are shaping it only at the margins. Surprise, surprise. We have not actually seen the nature of what's happening. It is coming more fresh. There has been much more of a domination perspective that has gone on previously relative to the military and what's going on here. So what they've been trying to do is really look at what is the culture of the organization, how actually do you deploy the airspace and cyber domains with the personnel, but moreover, how do you actually change what's happening with airmen? How do you develop them? All of this is in the context of 2035. 2035. They're looking out. If it was technology that couldn't impact before 2035, that was not on the table. But they did a deep dive only in two areas, one of which was around the biotech and the cyber, biotech and the pharma link, and the second is around cyber. And I'm just going to give you a couple of implications out of that, a couple of contexts out of it, because it starts to frame up at least a reality for the nature of what's emerging, the surprises that could be coming with it, and the challenges that are faced by a group of people that have to respond with leaders who are adept recognizing this reality. And one of the big implications of this for the military, probably not wholly different from us as leaders, is they've got a cycle of decision-making and thinking. They call it OODA, Orient, Observe, Decide, and Act. And that cycle is changing, and it's being compressed because the nature of technology is taking humans more and more out of the picture. And they're being driven out of the decision loop. This OODA, which has always been a cycle, is now in the military and the responsive world, especially in the cyber world, it's actually becoming more of an OODA point and actually even becoming needing a response so fast that it's actually beyond the speed of our brain and our capacity in many respects as leaders to respond to it. So we're building in these cycles of response and the humans being driven out of it. There are ethical concerns involved in it. There is the man in the loop. And how do you keep the leader in the loop? How do you keep the airman, the military man? How do you keep the leader in the loop just the way as our technological challenges are becoming more significant in our organizations? How do you get the information? How are you at the leading edge? How are you responsive in the way that you have to be responsive? It's magnified in the military. The costs are dramatic and they cost lives when that response is not actually well done. So they've got a whole array of ways they go about thinking about it. One way to think about it is that from the biological and the DNA and the pharmacological side is they're looking at how do you enhance capacities to keep the armed forces, keep our men and leaders and women in the loop. And there's a whole exploration around artificial intelligence, around intelligence augmentation, around education and training. There's a huge dimension of this. But what might be possible and what we're seeing to compress this OODA cycle is the use of biology and pharmaceutical enhancement to enhance the capacities to be able to impact the DNA so that improved, enhanced thought capacities, nervous system capacities to keep us calm in the face of what's really going on. Really, it's almost the notion of of turning the human, almost weaponizing the human into a healthier, faster, brighter, and stronger human, nano-engineered through pharmaceuticals to be able to do that. This is part of what is going on. This is part of the process of what's unfolding. The new human, tangible form that we can see here, is it not? And with it, clearly there are some downsides. All of this can be turned to the negative because there's a sense of not only can you work with this increased functionality to run faster, improve strength, make decisions more quickly, you have the nano-engineered precise control possibility of opponents in which you would impact their brain function, impact their decision-making capability, impact them to the detriment of what the possibility might be. This is the nature. This is this edge, this razor edge of what's going on in terms of development. This is actually part of the underpinning. And we're seeing even more about it, about what they're doing in education. They're doing a tremendous amount in education that's revolving around simulations and live direct experiences. My consulting business for years, we really built the nature of our practice on this direct experience. They are actually even doing it more. They are doing it with the real work and simulating the real work. All of this is to keep the man or woman, the military man or woman, keep the Air Force future leader in the loop. And they're doing it by demonstrating a proclivity. They're actually selecting people and will be, as the time unfolds, selecting them for their capacities for success in a chaotic environment, for success and the potential of success in using genetics, and potentially the success in the way of thinking. They are doing this to actually engage them, and they're instilling a philosophical and a psychological capacity to expect and accept surprise. They're supporting it with these tangible dimensions, but the nature of it is an environment which is built around dealing with chaos, uncertainty, and surprise. And more than that, I think one of the surprises to me out of the study, and if you were to describe what one possible dimension of a Manhattan Project might be for the Department of Defense, it's how to use the human genome, the gene to function Rosetta Stone that's going to build increased capacity, not only of the forces and of our side and leaders, but how this would be used to functionally have greater capabilities above others, but also impact others. It is a very interesting situation, certainly ethical underpinnings, but how do you develop your own capacities and degrade others? All that is underpinning the nano and biotech world. So there's a whole flow of that. There's a flow of where they go with that. There's a flow of where they go in understanding the cyber world, that the cyber world in 2035, it's not better, but it is radically different. It is driven by innovation. Transparency changes the game, and no longer is dominance possible. It's almost like in the years past when we talked about former Chairman Watson of IBM saying that there would be a place for five large computers in the world. That's the market. Well, the suggestion is there may be an evolution that we think about the world and the internet really as one single large computer, one single large mind of sort, and that's the transparency that provides the context and the opportunity to integrate knowledge, to integrate things, and how in fact then we begin to use it functionally in live domains. For example, if this were so connected in 2035, if you walked into your local town and you were caught on camera, that if a police officer was to come in, they would take a snapshot of that. This proliferation of information across the web and the way it's captured now could be so pervasive that they would be able to know who you are, your credit rating, the other people that are surrounding you, the likelihood of some sort of a deal going on that was illicit. The really big brother dimension of it is incredible. It is actually stunning to think about, as well as where the evolution of this and the war in the cloud really goes. But that's really just the starter on it. I think that most importantly, the big news and the reason for introducing is this, that they're thinking about the strategic airmen and women and the leaders that thrive on chaos and under continuous threat, that view surprise as the norm, and they excel under an avalanche of data. They actually are able to and develop even more fully around anticipating futures. Futures and understanding futures is a key orientation, and leveraging the technologies to be able to deal with the complexities is a critical dimension of the leaders and leadership of the future. The age of surprise, and I think while the Air Force context may not be yours and mine, there are parallels, and that's why I mention them. The leader of the future, let me repeat that, thriving on chaos, views surprise as the norm, excels under an avalanche of data, leverages technologies to master complexities, and I would add certainly more to that. We've been talking about sort of these interior capacities, the unilocal perspectives of knowing and knowledge, but surprise as the norm, surprise as the backdrop, and that's really what I want to make sure that you have attention to today. Surprise is what we can anticipate as we live into this future, even though we're anticipating 2013 and the economics and the realities of the in-the-mud system. That's the perspective. So, that's where we are today. We've kicked the cliff down the road. I've given some perspective. We've talked about the age of surprise. Let me close today with an arena that might be for some a surprise. I don't think it should be a surprise to any of it. And I'm going to return just for a moment to our financial world, to our mythical financial world, as I might call it. And I was stimulated this morning by, as I mentioned, Bank of America. I saw a multi-billion dollar settlement that came across my path. But a quick summary, perhaps, of the financial news that leads us to not being surprised. And here's a couple of things. What happens, folks, if you help Mexican drug dealers launder $7 billion of drug profits through U.S. branches, you finance purchases for international terrorists committed to attacks in America, and you have processed $60 trillion, that's $60 trillion with a capital T, and questionable activity in 17,000 suspicious accounts, what happens? Well, obviously, you don't go to prison, much less face the electric chair. Indeed, if you're a big bank, the U.S. state and federal authorities decide you should not even be indicted with criminal charges. Why? Because that might shake confidence in your bank, and you see your bank, no bank has ever survived criminal charges against top management. And so we read this, that HSBC, perhaps the biggest money laundering racketeer in the world history, won't be prosecuted. Instead, in yet another vigorous rump-kissing, I would say, I'm quoting here from Randall Ray, another rump-kissing by President Obama's Justice Department, HSBC will just pay a settlement. The Justice Department's Larry Brunner trumpeted the $2 billion settlement he worked out with the fraudsters, bringing the total that he's gotten from global money launderers to $4 billion. Folks, we're talking about, these are trillion-dollar plus banks. They've paid out $4 billion. A trillion is $1,000 billion. The mob would love this kind of deal. And think about the flagrantly fund terrorists and money launderers, and think about the consequence involved here, a slap on the wrist. You can't make this stuff up, folks. And the question is, are we out of the woods? And the answer is no, we're not out of the woods. Where the banks are not only too big to fail, as I mentioned at the beginning, they're too guilty to prosecute. And Bank of America, I saw that, was a pittance yet again, a few paltry billion dollars in light of the trillions involved in it. Crime pays, folks. The inside game is at play. This is the reality of what we're seeing. And we have a veritable litany of other settlements, other lawsuits, all these going on relative to the banksters. I can go down and enumerate them. We've got everything ranging from J.P. Morgan and Credit Suisse and Credit Suisse and settlements. Freddie and Fannie have initiated small suits against 17 banks. We've got B of A, as I've talked about. We've got all kinds of different ways we could slice and dice this. But you see the pattern here? See the context that we're living into, the context of this mythical situation. In addition to all these lawsuits and the demands for putbacks and the settlements, banks still, folks, hold tons of garbage. And all that, and despite three rounds of quantitative easing through which the Fed has taken much of the toxic wastes off their balance sheets. If we add it all together, $1 trillion of unsecured credit, plus $1 trillion or more of student loans, plus $1 trillion or more of credit card debit and other consumer debt, what we find is that it totals up to an amount equal to the bubble era peak before the crisis. There has been no material deleveraging of the household sector, certainly some leveraging, not necessarily material. And how can they, folks, pretend to be solvent? Because this game is extend and pretend, as Randall describes so well. Don't be surprised, folks. During the era, the speculative era of the mid-2000s, many quipped that assets were marked to myth. Traders just made up the prices for the trash. Folks, we're still living in this mythical world of high finance. We are still supporting it. We are still providing the context of influence. The inside game, the inside job is still incurring and being incurred. Folks, Randall says it well. It will crash again, and I agree with him. We must not be surprised. And that's where we're going to go today. Start off with the fiscal cliff. We have kicked it down the road. We are in an era, an age, an era of surprise and extraordinary change. We do see the financial system continuing to unfold massive, massive amounts of debt and leverage and further evolution of what we've seen before. Don't be surprised, folks. Get ready for it. We're at the front line seats. We are watching and acting ourselves, but most importantly, we are bringing our own leadership to bear, our own perspective. But folks, enough for now. Have a great week. As always, enjoy. See you next time. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel, and have a terrific week. The Zoomed Leadership conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership, capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.